Welcome to Baseball Biz on Deck. I'm Mark Carpenter, host, and man, I am glad you are here today. I have a very special guest, Mr. Rick Vaughn. He's the author of 100 Years of Baseball on St. Petersburg Waterfront. But man, I tell you what, it's great having you here. I look at your record and everything that you've done. I mean, working with the Orioles, working with the Redskins, and then 20 years with the Rays as like the VP of communications. I thought, my gosh, man, having yourself involved with sports all around you, I couldn't imagine anything more exciting than that.
Well, thanks, Mark. I was very lucky, in the right place at the right time on more than one occasion. And I've lived a great life. My experiences with the Orioles were, we never won there when I was there. I was there from 84 to 94, but I wouldn't trade those 10 years for anything. You know, it really was kind of the beginning of the slide down in terms of wins and losses for the organization. But it was a time when we were emerging as from being a mom and pop operation to, the corporate world. And so I was a part of that growth. And then, we did Camden Yards, closed Memorial Stadium, open Camden Yards, hosted the All-Star Game. Three best years of my career. It was so much fun. And there was the passion there, it was so great. And I was so lucky to be a part of that. And then coming down to, the Redskins for a couple of years was interesting. We weren't another not very good teams, couple of rough years there. And then when I got the chance to get back into baseball, we had come down to Florida for spring training for 10 years with the Orioles. So we were aware of it at about 7 weeks at a time, and we always loved it. And we got the chance to come down and the 20 years there were, we raised our family and they got to be raised around baseball. And so everything was a great ride for me.
Yeah, I mean, if you love baseball, you can't get a much better spot. I mean, for spring training and then even the minor leagues through the rest of the year, it's fantastic. I'm glad you found value here, and we're going to talk about somebody who kind of initiated the value of baseball in Tampa, and specifically in St. Pete. I mean, in your book, 100 Years of Baseball on St. Petersburg Waterfront, there's one guy. One guy that if he wasn't there, I don't know what happened. And that's Mr. Al Lang. Many of y'all may realize the Al Lang Stadium or field, but you may not know who he was. And shame on you if you don't. But Rick, you really give us some insight to this guy. I mean, here's this guy from up north. Doctor says you got poor health. You need to go south, young man. You need to go south and get better. What was the impetus for that? Once he got started here, what's lit the fire with him in baseball?
Yeah, I think when he was growing up in Pittsburgh, I think he, from what I can tell, he lived close to one of the hotels where the visiting teams that played the Pittsburgh Alleghenies stayed. And I think he hung around just became a huge fan of the game. And, when he got the opportunity to come south, I don't think he knew too much about St. Petersburg, but he fell in love with it. And he was very successful at a young age. He took over the family, basically the laundry business, and he worked his tail off, and it also made him sick. And so he had made a good bit of money. He was fortunate enough where he could come down here and not really have to work. And so he ended up becoming a two-time mayor of St. Petersburg. Wow. But he came down and he had this great love for baseball, and it didn't take him long to fall in love with St. Petersburg. And it was that, the coming together of those two passions of his and a wife who was very understanding. He was the greatest ambassador for St. I don't know that anybody has ever been a greater ambassador for the city than him. And, you're right. I worked there in that ballpark for a couple of years with the Orioles and 10 years with the Rays as spring training home for us, our first 10 years. And I knew who Al Lang was. He was the guy that brought baseball to St. Pete, and I had no really idea really what he did. And he not only brought baseball here, he brought like the best teams. And he not only brought the best teams, he kept them here. And that was more challenging than getting them here, I think, because baseball teams can be pretty demanding. And you can imagine, you know, the Yankees came in 1925 and didn't leave until 1961. And you can imagine over that time how many cities came after them, because obviously they're being in St. Pete for 6-7 weeks every year, just incredible, help the whole tourism industry really explode in St. Pete. You know, I read at some point the sports editors of the papers up north in New York, and we also at the same time for about 13 years had the Boston Braves and the Yankees at the same time. So he had two of the three largest media markets in the country in St. Pete, and the sports editors up north didn't even bother putting Florida on their dateline. They just put St. Petersburg because everybody knew where it was.
They didn't think Russia, Al Lang had identified, this is the St. Petersburg.
No confusion there.
You know, and he's doing this at a time, what was there, 12 or 16 teams when he first started all this?
Well, when he first started going after it, there were only like four teams. But thanks to him, I mean, he was another, not only was he a great ambassador for St. Pete, but it really got to the point where if you were going to bring a team, if you were a team owner and you were considering moving your operation to Florida for spring training, he was the man to see. He was the guy that you went to talk to before you did anything. So he wasn't just a great ambassador for St. Pete. He became a great ambassador for the state in terms of bringing teams here. And I mean, eventually it got, you know, to the point where it got up to like 16 teams. So, and he probably had a hand in most of those teams. You know, he worked with them. He had experience with working with the city of St. Petersburg on both sides, being the mayor and being a baseball guy. And he was also a master of promotion. I read where, and I didn't know this until I found it, St. Petersburg might have been the first city in the country to hire a PR person just for the city. And so, you know, they did a great job of pumping out all this, you know, the photos, the wire photos from St. Pete were either, you know, young ladies in bathing suits at the beach or maybe people at the ball game with the sunshine and the water in the background, which you could do with Al Lang being field right on the water there. So, I don't think you could ever overstate what Al meant to the city and how it defined the city really from the 20s, really up until when the Mets left in 87. Think about that. You had New York media presence basically there from 1925 to 1987. So you can see what that did for the profile of the city. And it really became kind of a media center for the country for, you know, the first quarter of every year. And, you know, it's indisputable what that meant, you know, to the city's profile and how it, you know, he was smart enough to take baseball and tourism and let baseball carry a lot of the water. Not all of it, because that wasn't the only reason people came down. But I saw various polls that were conducted during that span of the 20s through the 80s. And everyone I saw, the majority of people that were polled came to, you know, were tourists, and they mentioned baseball as one of the reasons that they came down. So pretty hard to dispute that.
Yeah. I mean, when you think, well, like I said, hired their first PR person or maybe one of the first ones in any city. I'm looking down here at some of the notes I made from reading your book. And looking from 1920 to 1930, I think there's a Census Bureau statement you say where the population for St. Pete increased from 14,000 to 39,000. Yeah. Good Lord, man. You know, that's just unbelievable. And I know that from what I read deep into the book. First off, I want to stop for a moment, Rick. I want to tell folks, when you read this book, I love it because there's great stories to be told. But Rick stops and gives us moments too in dates where we could pause and say, oh, damn, you know, but be that as it may, I was very intrigued to see that. And one of the statements later in the book, you're talking about the shift from the tourism during, I guess, spring training time to summertime. But the impression that Al Lang did in baseball early on, the 20s, the 30s, and continuing through, and you look at the teams he brought here. It was the Braves. It was the Yankees. We're talking the top-tier teams. I mean, these cheese and crackers, that's got to make all the difference.
Well, you know, the interesting thing too was the Braves were came to the waterfront first. They started in 1922, and Waterfront Park had been around just for a year, but it had been a minor league ballpark for the St. Pete Saints that were in the Florida State League. So they had to upgrade it for the Braves. And the Braves, they did all of their work there. They played their games there. The Yankees, the way that really Al Lang got the Yankees to come was that they had to build them a practice facility because both teams couldn't use the Waterfront Park. So they built what was back then was called Crescent Lake Park off of 4th in St. Petersburg. It's Hugenstengel today. You know, it's still there and it's used, I think, as a municipal field. But, so he gets both of these teams there. And then at some point, the Braves seem to maybe get a little put out of probably being the second team there, and they leave. And I remember they left. I'm not exactly sure of the exact day, but it would be something like this. They left like on a Tuesday. And by Saturday, Al Lang had the Cardinals coming in. So he had the two most, you know, he loses a media market, but then he gains the second most successful team in major leagues. And he already had the first one. And plus, St. Louis was the westernmost team in the major leagues at that time. So you had that big expansive market there. So didn't miss a beat. And then the Cardinals, of course, were there for 60 years, you know.
Jeez. That just completely, you know, knocked me down when I read that. First off, you had these two great teams that got here and to share a field. You know, that's something I think. Is it down Port St. Lucie? I think there's still a couple of teams that share a field, or Jupiter. But
Jupiter, yeah. Yeah, Jupiter. It's who is it? It's, I think it's the Nationals, and I don't even remember the other team, but there are two teams down there sharing a facility. Maybe it's the Marlins or the Nationals. I'm not sure.
That sounds right. But the thing of it is, to me, one, to get two teams here and get them to share a field, that was something. I mean, he must have been one heck of a negotiator. Who wouldn't just love to have this guy as your CEO or your head of development public relations? I mean, in today's world, to be able to capture the audience at a top tier level, talking about the audience being the CEOs, the owners of teams. And yeah, you know, you've got a great atmosphere down here. People are going to love to be in the sunshine, but it was more than that. I mean, one of the things you said, Rick, I can't remember specifically. We're talking about where other teams were having to basically offer money, I think, to the teams to get them to come to their community. And Al pretty much didn't do much of that. He was pretty much, here I am, here's what we offer, and here's what I'll do when you come here.
Yes, that's right. Tampa got a team a year before St. Petersburg did. The Cubs came to, and this was before Waterfront Park. This was 1913. The Cubs came to Tampa, but the city had to pony up. They had to pay the Cubs to come. And then they left after a few years, and they went through a few teams in Tampa. Babe Ruth and the Red Sox came in 1919, and then the Senators came in 20. And eventually there became negotiations where teams weren't paying, or cities weren't paying teams to come anymore, because they were offering them plenty of incentives. And St. Pete, you're right. You're right. Al Lang was a tremendous negotiator, and he was also willing to do whatever he had to do to keep those teams there. You know, I mean, he went the extra mile on every possible thing that he could, and he had the time and he was devoted to it. And, I don't think you could ever overstate what he meant to baseball in the state of Florida and what he meant to St. Pete.
It's real easy. Well, not easy. It's in a sense easy to give kudos to Al Lang for the things he achieved in baseball. But I also think of the things he did as a philanthropist, and sometimes as a quiet philanthropist. You know, I'm looking in the book, you're talking about through the Depression, you know, some of the things that he did, I think, was for players. He's talk about loading up the car with groceries and not so much on a person to person level, but even with the Yankees, I believe it was, he was trying to give some recompense for their losses during the Depression. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, players now and then is the same. It's true today is they don't get paid during spring training. And so Al had some money, you know, put aside. And beyond that, he had relationships with everybody in the city. You know, he had been the mayor for two different terms. He had been down there. He got there in around 1910. So he'd been down there for 20 years. And so he knew everyone. Everyone knew him. He had trust. And he was able to help the players, those players that were having trouble, you know, finding, you know, paying their rent, buying their food. And I think that just shows you how devoted that he was to what was going on down there. I mean, and even the writers, you know, even some of the writers that were having troubles making ends meet, he made sure that they didn't, you know, they were not put out. You know, I love the fact that when they announced that the Yankees were coming in 1925, he immediately went to the city and he wanted to get the train from St. Pete to go up to New York and bring them all down, you know, to kind of get a chance to look at the city before spring training started. I mean, that's how his mind worked. You know, I mean, it was just, he was a master promoter, but he had a great heart and he did help people like that. And, you know, speaking of the Depression, I talked to one historian who he said to me, you know, I don't have any definite proof of this, but I have to believe, and I do believe, that having the Braves and the Yankees there during the Depression, it brought moneyed people down to St. Pete. When you walk down Central Avenue at that point, you saw a good number of cars that were New York and Massachusetts license plates. And not everyone was affected by the Depression. You know, they were the people that had money were able to do things like that. And because of baseball, because of the beach and because of the sunshine, people came and they brought money with them. And so I've had this one fella tell me, he goes, I'm reasonably believe that St. Pete got out of the Depression a little earlier than some of the other cities in Florida because of the fact that you had that those people in the town for a quarter of the year every year.
I remember reading the book at one point. I think somebody was trying to do some PR for up north and said something about, like, to the effect of, oh, come to St. Pete and wait out the Depression here.
And right. That's right. I did see that. That was actually one of their publicity messages that they pumped out back then. You know, they actually did do that, that this was a great place to wait it out. And I'm sure it worked. I'm sure it got some people down here anyway.
Well, again, massive promotion marketer, Al Lang. And let's take another moment in Al Lang and St. Pete history. Babe Ruth, bringing the Babe to St. Pete. I love the whole theater that was involved with that, with the train and the crowds and everybody to the stadium. Give us a little bit about the Babe's arrival.
Yeah, I love talking about his role here, because when he had been in Tampa just for 1 year, and that was in 1919, and I since researched that after I put the book out, he was only there for like two weeks because he held out like he normally did with his contract situation. So he was late getting there, and the Red Sox weren't there that long. So he was only in Tampa for a couple of weeks. So he probably never came over to St. Pete. It wasn't an easy drive back then either. So he probably never made it over. And he had this preconceived idea. I mean, the Yankees were moving from New Orleans to St. Pete. And one of the reasons they wanted to leave New Orleans was, you know, the Babe and the nightlife there were not exactly a positive mixture. So they come over, and he was very critical of the area when the first year, you know, not a lot went right for them that first year. Actually, even that season, that was like they had their worst season that they would have in the next like 50 years. That first year in St. Pete, they did not play well. They did not finish in the first division of the league. And everybody was kind of down on the whole experience. And even the owner, Murdoch, was questioning Al Lang, what have you gotten me into down here? You know, that kind of thing. And then eventually it didn't take long, but I think their eyes got opened, all of them. And, you know, eventually the New York writers referred to 1925 as the year that St. Petersburg was discovered, you know, because it was when the Yankees came. Oh, yeah. But they fell in love with it. And Ruth, who had been very critical of the area as being, you know, a sleepy little town and not much going on, after he had a chance to get to know the people and the area, you know, he changed his tune. One of the things I found interesting, his birthday is in early February. And the last 6 years that he was with the Yankees, five of the years he came down to spring training early to celebrate his birthday in St. Petersburg. So I think it kind of grew on him after a while. And, you know, he was very, he got involved in the community. You know, All Children's Hospital back then was started right at the during the time when the Yankees were there. It was a Crippled Children's Hospital is what it was called. And he was involved with that. He was involved in helping that get that off the ground when he was down there. And, you know, he just, you know, he became such a symbol of St. Petersburg there for quite a while, you know, until he left the Yankees after the 34th season and he signed with the Braves. And of course, he's back down here again for another year of spring training in 1935. And that was one of the scenes I think you were talking about when they came, when that train came down and, you know, he all along the whole route, you know, in Florida, every stop they made, there were people at the train stations waving and, you know, wanting a piece of him, you know. And then when he got here in St. Pete, it was late afternoon. There were literally thousands of people at the train station and many of them were kids. And so it's pretty hard to gauge what kind of impact he had and what he meant here in this in the community. But he really became a huge fan. And he was down here after he retired. He came down here for different events and to play golf. And I think he really I used a quote at in the end of the book from his daughter who was talking about how much he loved, you know, coming to St. Petersburg. So he really turned around quickly on the whole vibe of our city.
The excitement that must have been buzzing in the town, like I said, with the people who were coming to the games and people meeting at the railroad. I remember as a child when I grew up in Louisville, when the Cardinals would have a fantastic game, wanting to go to the airport or a bus somewhere to catch the team, even as a high schooler, you know, rah, rah, the team as they come back off the bus. The excitement, I can't imagine the magnitude, you know, with Babe Ruth on something like that. But it seems like they said it, what Babe and Al Lang did to propel St. Petersburg in the national eye and to propel baseball here as well. And while it wasn't always in St. Pete, I mean, if you or I or anyone picks up now and says, oh, let's take a look at what's the minor league map look like in Florida right now. And man, it's a splatter, but there's plenty of spots where that splatter goes. I mean, we've got them in Winter Haven with the Detroit Tigers. We got them in Dunedin with the Jays. We got, let's see who else, Clearwater, the Threshers, Phillies. You know, the Marauders.
Yankees are in Tampa, and the Pirates are in Bradenton. Orioles are in Sarasota. You've got the Braves now in Northport. And so, yeah, you have a lot of, it's great. It's really great.
On the show, I always really push people to go out and see the games in the minor leagues, because for one thing, there's an excitement. I went over, saw the Yankees and the Threshers play earlier this year, and somebody got hit by a pitch, and don't you know it, both sides just emptied out onto the field. You've got, two umpires at that level, and they're trying to figure out who to throw out. You know, it takes them 5 to 10 minutes to stop the game, and finally, I think they just threw their hands up, said, let's, you know, go ahead and play ball. But minor leagues are fun, not to mention watching guys come up. I mean, I remember going down to, Port Charlotte, and seeing, you know, Josh and Nate or Nathaniel Lowe play ball down there. It's like, you know, these guys, and they come up and you see them in the system. People, even the Wander Franco, we all knew what he was going to be when he came. But to be able to see these guys at minor league stadiums and fields is just, it's exciting. It's amazing. And it's nice to be able to say, I saw them win, you know. And one moment you mentioned at Al Lang Field, and I think it was Derek Jeter, I think his first game, and Ozzie Smith his last. Was that?
Yeah. At the ballpark there. Yeah. There, you know, there was one year, I think it was 1968, where there were like 28, 29 future Hall of Famers came through. Now, part of that was because they had two teams. So there were games there often. You know, there were not too many days when one of the teams wasn't playing. But that was a real golden age. You know, there were a lot of Hall of Famers playing at that time. And having the two teams here afforded St. Petersburg the opportunity to see some of the greatest pitchers ever, some of the greatest hitters ever. You know, these are future Hall of Famers, but still, these were, some of them were well into their career. You know, Willie Mays got to play here 1 year in 1973 with the Mets. So that was his last spring training. And so, you know, people had that opportunity to get to see Willie Mays play here. I mean, it's, you know, when you live down here, this is your opportunity to watch baseball. Yeah. You know, I've been doing a little research. I'm thinking about doing another sort of a companion book on Tampa and Tampa's experience. And it's amazing how many, you know, there's 90 Tampa natives that have played Major League Baseball now, which is amazing. But it's pretty cool that almost all of them, their first major league games that they ever saw were over at Al Lopez Field, you know, in Tampa. So there's that opportunity that spring training gives, you know, these guys, and maybe inspires them that they wouldn't be inspired if you didn't have a spring training team there, you know?
I can't imagine not enjoying those. I mean, like myself, just being able to watch those young men, you know, grow up through the system. And if you're a Tampanian, go watch a game at Plant High School, Gaither High School. I mean, you've seen Pete Alonso and Kevin Cash come from there. What, Hillsborough? Doc came from there. And you look at all these guys, Gary Sheffield. Well, guess what? You could have seen him in high school. You could have seen him in minor leagues at some point. So right now, there's a guy out there playing ball at a high school or in a minor league that you're going to be seeing 3 to 5 years from now. Wow. You know?
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. Tampa's a very, very shining example of that kind of thing. I found a newspaper from the early 80s where Seaver was pitching at Al Lopez Field against the Reds, and Gooden had pitched at the same time was pitching for Hillsborough High Schools, you know.
So, wow.
You know, at the time, you don't know what you're seeing, but you look at it now and you're like, holy cow, you know. Yep. Talk about a rich area, you know. So you're right. You're right.
So, I continue to tell folks, go out and see some of these minor league games. If you're not, you're really missing out. But go ahead and enjoy your major league team. God knows I do. And, you know, a funny thing, though, too, Rick, is I find myself less and less following the laundry, as some would say, and following players instead. Partly just because I've gotten to deeper enjoyment of the game with, you know, through the Rays. You know, whether it was with Longoria going, and God help poor Neander that first year, because I know hell was raised from a lot of fans, but then seeing who came in from after that, you know, even more recently, a couple of years ago, seeing Willie Adames go, oh, that hurt a lot of people in their heart. But there were things where the Trop wasn't necessarily the best place for Willie, and it worked out, you know, it's worked out fairly well with him with the Brewers, you know. So yeah. I can look at the Brewers now and see, is it Brasso there? I can't remember.
He is. I think he is. Yeah. Yeah. He's playing there.
You got Mike Brasell. You got Timmons, you know, who was the first base coach. So you can follow your race, but it doesn't have to stop from the confines of Tropicana. So I don't know. I'm kind of going off on a tangent here, except.
No, I agree with you. I mean, minor league baseball, I score some of the games for the Florida State League teams and the Complex League games. And, like last year, I saw Carl Crawford's son playing for the Phillies Complex League team.
Wow.
And I was kind of blown away. He had a good game, and he got to show off his speed. And then I've seen him a couple times this year with the Threshers. You know, he's in the Florida State League, and he's tearing it up. I mean, he's hitting like 340. I think he's stolen something like 38 out of 42 attempts. He's got great speed, and you know, he's going to fill out. He's still like, he's like 6'1", 175, you know, he's going to fill out a little more. He's not quite as big as his daddy was at that time. I think Carl was like 6'2", 215. He was a little bit heavier and bigger. He was more like a football player than his son is. And he kind of ran that way. And this kid is so graceful. And he is worth, by the way, they're very good. The Threshers have a great team. You know, the Rays got off to the great start. Well, they didn't even have the best record in Tampa Bay because the Threshers had a better record than they do. That's how good they've been. So I would definitely recommend going out there. And it's a great ballpark. It's a really, really good park. When we were going through the remodeling of down in Port Charlotte of the ballpark down there in 2008, when we were getting ready to move in 2009, we spent a lot of time. Our people spent a lot of time up at the ballpark, the Threshers Park off of 19, because it's really, really well designed, not just for fans, but for people that are working in that building.
Well, and that's important. I mean, it has to be a great experience. And, you know, just briefly mentioned to the Yankees. And I mean, if it wasn't for spring training there, you would never expect that feel for a minor league team. But my gosh, again, living here in Tampa, you have a chance to see some excellent players, excellent teams, and stadiums and fields that are for most part, pretty daggone good.
Yeah, I think they are. I think the Threshers is probably the best one that I've been in, and it's now, you know, withstood the test of time. It's been there now for almost 20 years, and you wouldn't know it. You know, I love the fact that when you go to a game there and you're sitting in the bowl down low, you don't even remember that the busiest freaking road in Florida is right over the right field wall there on 19. I love the fact that you kind of lose yourself in that ballpark. You know, I think that's such a testament to what they did, that what they've done there.
Yeah, I want to come back to your book for a moment. And as we look at this gentleman who's done so much to build the game in St. Pete, he died in, 1960, I believe.
Yes, that's right.
You know, it's interesting, too, because at that same time, it's like a certain awareness comes to people that should have been there all along. And I'm talking about segregation of the players. You know, I used to hear the stories about being separated at the Vinoy, you know, or players were asked not to come to the pool, even if they were able to stay in the same place. I mean, the outrigger, which I tell you, give us a couple stories. I mean, the Cardinals and outrigger, I think, is kind of an interesting one.
Yeah, I was lucky because I got to talk to Bill White, who's still with us. And, you know, Bill was a very key player in a lot of the movement that went on there in a positive way with regards to civil rights. And I said to him, you know, I was, barely born when all of that was going on. But I got the impression that when Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in 1947, that a lot of people felt like all was good with baseball. And it really wasn't. You know, particularly in the South with spring training. And he said that's exactly what it was. And there was a guy by the name of Dr. Ralph Wimbush, who lived in St. Petersburg, was a civil rights leader. And for a number of years, he actually hosted family, the players in his house, and got some of his friends to host the Black players in their homes in South St. Pete. And in February of 1961, he came to the realization that he wasn't helping things by doing that, that wasn't going to bring about change. That was just accommodating. And so he came out and said, I'm not doing that anymore. And he goes, I love these players, but I'm not going to do it. And he was doing it for the right reason. And so that kind of ignited a little spark. There was a Chamber of Commerce breakfast right at the beginning of spring training that was kind of muddled. It was not really clear to this day how it happened, but none of the Black players were invited to the chamber breakfast that morning. And that got Bill White's attention, and Bill White started talking about it. And Wendell Smith, a writer from the African-American newspaper in Chicago, he started writing about it. So here's Bill talking about it, and Wendell's picking it up, and things started to get stirred up. And the Yankees, to their credit, when they left in 1961, they had three or four reasons why they left. They were at a point where they really wanted to have their own facility and not share anything, which was part of it. And they wanted a bigger stadium. But one of the other parts was they wanted all their players under one roof. And they found that in Fort Lauderdale. And so they left. And the Cardinals, realizing, you know, they needed to respond in a way on this too, they ended up buying a hotel out near the Skyway Bridge. And so all of their players stayed at that hotel. And even the players like Stan Musial, the first year, you know, these guys were living on their own in houses on the beach. They all came and stayed at the hotel as kind of a solidarity thing. And, I said to Bill, I was talking to Bill about this, and he said, you know what? We didn't get caught up in a whole lot of that as a team. We just wanted to win. And Amen. We knew that if we had a chance to come together, this was a great thing for us to do as a team. And so, you know, he talked about like they would all be in the same pool and the wives would get together and they would have meals together, and that people would drive by the hotel and stop and look and see Blacks and whites in the same pool, and wonder how that how that came to be. So it wasn't, you know, and Bill Veeck, you have to mention Bill Veeck was in Sarasota. He was very progressive in his thinking. He was ahead of his time in so many ways, and particularly in the civil rights issue. He's another one that was very instrumental in getting that whole, you know, the movement started. Now, there was still a lot, a long ways to go. And it was three, four years before the Civil Rights Act came along in 1964. But it at least got things started. And it started right there in St. Petersburg with the Cardinals and Bill White and the folks in St. Pete defying baseball. And baseball was very, you know, was not a lot of these hotels and to some extent Major League Baseball, they kind of hid behind these laws, these Jim Crow laws that were just ridiculous. They kind of hid behind those. Well, there's not much we can do. It's law. And it took people with a lot of courage to stand up. And finally, baseball by, by 62 and definitely 63, most of the teams there had left their hotels. So the hotels wouldn't budge. And they have found other accommodating hotels that would accommodate all their players.
So in MLB, did Florida actually lose teams to Arizona for spring training?
Well, they were worried about that. And that's something that Bill White mentioned to me. He said, you know, they were afraid they were going to be losing these teams, that the state was. And because Arizona didn't really have that problem. You know, there was not an issue like that in terms of the players being segregated. That was not an issue out there. I don't think they lost any teams at that time, but they were under pressure that they might. And so that was another very important part of it, Mark, that added a little bit of pressure to the whole situation.
We're talking with Rick Vaughn, author of 100 Years of Baseball on St. Petersburg Waterfront, and a man who's lived and breathed baseball and sports for his professional career as well. And I want to make an observation here, and you can tell me if I'm right or wrong, Rick. But as I read the story of Al Lang and I look at your history, I can't possibly see some parallels, man. You know, what you've done with baseball.
And
the philanthropy, too. All those things, working with charitable organizations. But I mean, you're both, in a sense, you know, working with the marketing and getting the word out. And I cannot even begin to think what that was like. I'm going to kind of jump the track completely here to your career with the Rays, because you didn't step on the field first day of spring training. You had a couple of years of work to take care of before they came. Can you tell us a little bit about marketing and prepping for that?
Yeah, you know, it was a challenge, to say the least. We had we got the team and they announced the team in 95. We didn't play a game till 98. I was hired in 96. And it was kind of daunting because it was one of those things where if you looked at the whole picture, you would get overwhelmed by everything that had to be done. And it seems like 2 years is a long time. But when you're dealing really from scratch, Chuck Lamar was our general manager. He hadn't hired one person. You know, now he had to hire, you know, all the people that are going to help with the major league staff, you know, the whole major league thing. And then he had to hire minor league people that were going to hire minor league folks. And it was fascinating to be a part of it. But we never, you know, you just never, I was down here the first 8 or 9 months by myself. My family was in Virginia and they stayed to get the girls through school and stuff. So I was down here by myself, which was a good thing because I just worked every single day. You know, I wasn't going to go to the beach, you know. And so whether it was a Saturday or a Sunday, you were still in there. I'll never forget, I was in the office one day and Chuck Lamar, now this is back in 1990, the end of 96, I think. And Chuck Lamar was coming through, you know, he was traveling a lot because he was meeting people and trying to hire people. And he came in one day and he was like, well, I think I just met the new manager of the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. I said, really, who? Now, this was long before really people knew about, he had not managed at the major league level yet. But he said, I met Mike Socia, and he's going to manage our ball club. And I said, really? How do you know that? And he goes, you know what? Sometimes you just meet somebody, you shake their hand, and you get this vibe. And he goes, I got this vibe. He's going to be a great manager. And I give Chuck credit. Now, we didn't get him because I think at the time he might have been a Dodger employee. I can't remember. think he was managing Albuquerque or whatever, but they wouldn't let him go. And so he got an opportunity, I guess, to go, you know, to improve himself. So we didn't get a chance to talk to him, to interview him for the job. But it was stuff like that that was happening, you know, that was pretty cool. I mean, we learned a lot. We, unfortunately, we could have, you know, quite candidly, I think we could have done a better job of marketing the team early. I think we had our owner, Vince Namoli, really had no experience at all about putting a, you know, doing this kind of thing, marketing. He didn't know the first thing about it. He had not been in that area. He had been in the supply side. So we, you know, I looked out in Arizona and they were doing some pretty progressive things in terms of marketing. They were smart. They hired Buck Showalter way early in the process. So they had somebody that was kind of the persona of the team, who was the manager of the year, like the year before, and he got let go by the Yankees. But he was a great person to have, as when you thought of the Diamondbacks in the two or three years leading up to their games, you thought of Buck Showalter, which was a positive thing, a baseball thing. And we really did not have that. And we, you know, we could have been a little bit more aggressive. I think Vince at times was like, you know, we don't need to be advertising right now. We've got, you know, we've got a couple of years before we're going to play games. And so sometimes I think we could have done a bit better job than we did. We had an owner who had never been an owner before on any level. We had a general manager who had never been a general manager before at any level. And even Larry Rothschild, when he came on board, he had never managed before. So we had a lot of people in high level positions that had never done what they were doing. And so there was a lot of learning going on when we first started. And, you know, I think if we could have done it again, I wish we'd have been a little bit more aggressive with some of the things early on instead of the way we handled it. But that being said, we got this team on the field. We did the best we could with a stadium that really was way behind. You know, it really was. You know, I did a lot of traveling with the teams when I was with the Orioles and the Rays, and I got to see all the ballparks. You know, I've seen them all. And you go to those parks, and yes, Tropicana Field, we know they're going to play. We know the temperature is going to be, it's going to be comfortable. But I think more than any sport, baseball really relies on the ballpark experience. And you go to these other ballparks and you see things and you're like, oh, that is so cool. You know, this different things at different ballparks, whether it's just the views or the things they have to offer, or, you know, things for kids, or, you know, and you realize that our fans are kind of missing out on that. And so I hope when we finally get this ballpark thing worked out here now, that yes, we are cognizant of it costs, but that we also do a good job in making the fan experience, you know, something that is going to bring people back to the ballpark. And I hope we don't cut corners and to make it something that can be affordable. So I'm hoping that all of those things will be lined up right. And that, like I said, I so many times I would see something at a ballpark and I'd be like, I wish our fans had a chance to see something like that, you know? So we'll see how it goes. But it was an unbelievable experience to be involved with it.
I cannot begin to imagine. I got to tell you, just only recently, my wife and I started beginning the circuit of the ballparks. Last year, we got to see the Nationals playing the Dodgers in D.C. And then this year, we went up to Fenway and got to see the Rays, you know, face off there in 41-degree weather and rain. But it was ugly, but it was beautiful. We went ahead and got tickets for Saturday and Sunday because we thought, I don't know if they're going to be able to play either day. But it was great to be there, and I look forward to those other experiences. And yes, I don't think that I realized how much that open ballpark meant to me, you know, having been the Trop had been pretty much my experience. And again, you know, some Yankees fans were there and some, I don't know why, but and also obviously some Red Sox, and they say, yeah. So I was in the trap. I said, I put my hand out in that cold rain. I said, you know what? I hear it's just fine. I'm not, you know, but yeah, I always say 72 degrees and no rain outs. But you know, the love of the game in the stadium, and we all, I'm not going to ask you, but people ask me every day when I'm working down there occasionally at the baseball museum. And they said, so what's going on with the Tampa Bay Rays? Are they going to be in Ybor? Are they going to be here? I said, your guess is as good as mine. I said, I just don't want to be Oakland in a couple of years. So.
Right. Well, I don't know what's going to happen. I do have some thoughts on, these are just my thoughts, uneducated thoughts, really. But I'd love to see them if they end up going to Tampa. And I don't know if that's going to happen or not. But I really would like to see them. Now that I've been doing some history on Tampa's past about baseball and realizing, you know, how baseball started there and the impact that it had on bringing that city of immigrants together, you know, largely Cuban, Spanish, Italians. And it was the cigar industry that really had a whole lot to do with that, with baseball. And they sponsored the teams. The Cubans that came in to work in the cigar factories were baseball fans. And so they sort of brought the game to us in Florida. And I'd love, if they end up going over there, I'd really love to see them incorporate the architecture of those old cigar warehouses. I would be like, if it was me, and this is just me, I'm no architect, and I'm certainly no owner, but I think I would look at it like, you know what, before we even put down any plans, let's take this approach. We're going to build a cigar factory in terms of the architecture, and we're going to put a baseball field right in the middle of that cigar factory. That's the way I wish they would look at it, you know, because I'm a Camden Yards guy. I was there when we built Camden Yards. And let me tell you something, it's still pretty hard to beat that ballpark. And one of the reasons was their whole approach was, we want to build a ballpark. If you walk past it, you don't necessarily know you're walking past a ballpark. It looks like the rest of the city. It looks like it belongs. And that's exactly what they did. And I think it just helps that whole notion about the ballpark and the ball team being a part of the community. I mean, I know that sounds a little far-fetched, but it really isn't. To me, it's kind of this subliminal message that, like, yeah, this is our team. This is our city. Look at this place. You know, it's ours. And I'd love, you know, I always told everybody when we were building it, you know, and the first couple of years, you could drop somebody down blindfolded from a helicopter and put them right on second base. And when you took the blindfold off, they would say, oh, I know where I am. I'm in Baltimore. This is Baltimore, you know, and that to me is very true. And I think I'd love to see, I'm not knocking the design that I saw on one of the parks that they had. Maybe it was the Tampa one, but it looked like a spaceship that landed in the middle of Tampa. And I know you know, to me, try to find ways to honor the past and then still incorporate all the amenities that you want in a ballpark that make it new and make it comfortable for people and make it a great experience. But I really think having this appreciation now for the history of over there, I'd love to see them do something like that. That being said, you know, I'd still like to see him finish it off here in St. Pete too. You know, if they can figure it out and make it a great experience for people, you know, not just because it's the cheapest place to put, you know, it's going to cost us the less money to put it there. If you're going to put it there, do it right. It has to be done right. And I think in Florida, that's how you have to do it. You know, there's just too much competition. You have to be perfect. The ballpark location has to be perfect and the ballpark itself has to be perfect. You know, I really believe that.
I think you're on the money, Rick. I think it's kind of hard to get there. And I'm looking for the modern day Al Lang. Is that you? I need somebody out there, man, to champion this cause because, baby, I'm ready for this one. You know.
Well, let me tell you something. What you're saying is exactly right. You need someone to champion it. You know, those ballparks that have gotten successful, that have been built, that are working now, most of the time, those cities had somebody that was a real champion for that ballpark. And we need that, you know, in this community, I think.
Yeah, I do. I do as well. You know, I know there's money and everybody feels tight about that and where that money's going to come from. But if you can build this enthusiasm, I think if you can, like you're saying, incorporate the whole idea of community and history into what that ballpark can be, I think a groundswell can be built beneath that. And again, whether it's in St. Pete or Tampa, we've got so much history here. I think either one of those would be a great component. I'd like it, obviously, in Tampa. I live in Plant City these days. I used to live in South Pasadena, so I'd catch a bus and I'd go to the game. But I don't know. This is a call to everyone right now listening to the show. We're looking for a champion right now. So please come forth, submit your resume. But man, yeah, I'm with you, brother. I'm absolutely with you. Again, we're talking with Rick Vaughn. He's the author of 100 Years of Baseball on the St. Petersburg Waterfront. And you're cooking up a book on Tampa as well, right?
I haven't actually submitted it to my publisher yet, but I've been doing some research. I've done a few interviews. I've gotten some great stories from Wade Boggs gave me a couple of good stories from his experiences at Al Lopez Field. And I talked to Tino Martinez the other day, and he had some really good experiences growing up there too. And I had no idea that he actually worked in a cigar factory when he was a kid, you know, which is, that's probably the only former major leaguer or major leaguer that can make that claim. But yeah, both cities were impacted by baseball, I think by a pretty good measure. But they were different. You know, to me, baseball in Tampa was all about bringing the community together in the late, 1800s and early 1900s, bringing those communities together. And then that passion for the game that became very obvious on ball fields down in Ybor City and West Tampa, that it kind of spilled out, across the city and developed this passion. And baseball was a unifier for that. And then I can't recall who the mayor was, but in 1910, 1911, they had like a labor situation going on among the tobacco workers. And so the city was fractured. And the mayor was like, you know, one way we can bring this community together might be to bring baseball here, Major League Baseball here. And lo and behold, it took them a few years, but they got the Cubs in 1913. And really, and except for a couple of years, they didn't have a team. The Cubs left it after 1916. They didn't have a team for a couple of years. Then the Braves came in, the Red Sox came in. And then it stayed. You know, the Reds ended up coming in 1930 and stayed until 1987. So baseball was there to stay, and it goes back to it kind of being playing on the passion of the people that love the game and unifying the city, not once, but really twice. And, what it meant, I found it was kind of interesting, you know, having a major league team in your city, what it can do for you. And I found one really shining example, and that was when they opened up Busch Gardens in 1959. August Busch Jr. was the owner of the Cardinals, and they were training in St. Pete. And when they had the grand opening, he said to everybody there, he goes, you know, this is only the fourth brewery in the country, and it's going to be here in Tampa, and we're going to have this great park called Busch Gardens. And it all came about because I had a baseball team over in St. Pete, and we used to go on these drives and discover the countryside, you know, what was the country, discover the community. And that's how I discovered why I wanted to put a brewery here, is because if he didn't have the Cardinals here, we wouldn't have Busch Gardens. Busch Gardens wouldn't be here. So I think if you look at things, you know, how baseball impacted Tampa that way. And I really have thoroughly enjoyed reading about it. It doesn't have quite the connection to the city like baseball did with St. Petersburg in terms of it functioning the way it did, but it still kept Tampa, you know, it wasn't a huge tourism city like St. Pete was, you know, it didn't have that resort feel. I think baseball kept Tampa on the forefront of people's minds in terms of it being a great city, you know, that it had baseball, you know, that it had so many great things to offer. And again, baseball brought that into the picture, you know, baseball helped bring that into the picture. And a lot of it had to do with Tampa's location. You know, a lot of media people and scouts and baseball people they stayed in Tampa because it was very centrally located to the other, you know, ballparks around the state. But I've enjoyed reading and discovering all of this. And I think it'll be more like anecdotal and memories and stuff of the area. A lot of stuff that I've learned that I never knew that happened here. Some really cool baseball things that happened in Tampa that I've never heard anybody recount. So I'm excited about it, and hopefully I'll get it moving here pretty soon.
Well, that's great, Rick. I tell you, I can't thank you enough. And I got to tell you, as I was reading through your book, 100 Years of Baseball on St. Petersburg Waterfront, in case I didn't say it earlier, the one thing, you talk about things popping up. You know, you got like those little factoids or those little moments on dates in history. And at first I thought, oh my gosh, is this the book? And as I was reading it through my Kindle, I'm going through all this. I found myself highlighting and highlighting and highlighting all this stuff I wanted to go back and read again. I enjoyed it so much. So I heartily endorse the book, man. And I recommend it for everybody. Like I said,
You know what, Mark? It's spring training, and I know a lot of people would dismiss it as that. But you know what? It still prompted many good baseball stories and many good things. And the statistics don't really matter, which I point out that in the book at an early part. But it's still baseball, and it's still baseball folklore or whatever you want to call it. And it's, to me, it's been kind of largely ignored. And so it seems like I've been able to research things that a lot of work hasn't been as much, you know, as a lot of other areas of baseball have been explored.
Well, Rick, I can't thank you enough for being today here on Baseball Biz on Deck, man. And I could have this conversation with you for another 3 hours because I've got topic after topic I'd love to talk with you about. Just, it's been great having you here, sir. Let you and I both hope a champion comes forth today for the Tampa Bay Rays. But no, seriously, man, I want to thank you again. And
no, this has been great. I've enjoyed every minute of it.
All right, brother. You can find Rick Vaughn's book on Amazon and elsewhere. The title of it is, again, 100 Years of Baseball on St. Petersburg Waterfront. Well, again, I want to thank everybody for joining us here today on Baseball Biz on Deck. And we'll be talking with you again real soon. Special thanks to XTake RUX for the music Rocking Forward.